Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Long before I made a conscious choice to work with children and youth, I worked with theater. My road from actor to director to facilitator to child and youth care practitioner was a wonderful and winding process. A great deal of what I learned about working with young people comes directly from my time as a theater artist. For example, I learned to attend, accept, and advance in my interaction with others. I learned that starting with "yes, let's" is far more effective than "no, because." I learned a great deal of what young people face involves conflict. Conflict with self, conflict with others, and or conflict with the structures around them. I strongly believe that art has a vital place in our culture, and using the arts with young people allows opportunities that other approaches just don't allow. Today's guest also believes in the power of art. Dr. Mary Stone Hanley is a performer, a poet, an educator, a playwright, and an artivist. She is the author of numerous articles and has most recently co-edited a book called Culturally Relevant Arts Education for Social Justice, A Way Out of No Way. This book is a wonderful and inspiring publication that I encourage all of you to pick up or have your local library order. Welcome, Dr. Mary Stone Hanley.
Well, thank you very much, Wolfgang, for inviting me. I'm pleased to sponge.
Oh, wonderful. Me too. Could we start by you telling me, what is an artivist?
Well, now that's a term I did not coin, but it is a term that has become really useful. It's a combination of activist and artist, and looking at the ways that the two inform each other. As an activist, you are a transformer. You transform the world. As an artist, you transform the world. And you using the art to transform the world is multiply what you can do in many different ways. And also, one of the things I've learned in my journey as an artivist is that you can reach people through the art in ways that people will not respond if you're going to give them a lecture or if you're going to make a speech, if you're going to demand something of them, but you can use the art both in ways that they create the art as well as the ways that they perceive and watch and audience the art. You can, the art allow people to open up to new ideas. And so it's a combination between activists and artists, and using both of those interests, abilities, choices, transform, create social change.
Did you start primarily as an artist? Did you start primarily as an activist? Was there a combination of the two right from the beginning of your work?
No. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, which we now call the Rust Belt. It was a steel-making, working-class town. And as an African-American in the early 20th century in the Rust Belt, the world was rather closed to me because everything was segregated. But as I went on through life, actually before, as a child there, the arts were always there. My mother and father encouraged my work in the arts. I wrote my first poem when I was 8 years old, and I created my first book, I'm making little quotation marks now, when I was 10. So writing and the arts have always been a part of me. I was in what they used to call them, I've forgotten the term for them, but there was a kind of arts community in Cleveland that were for people from working class and lower income. And my parents sent me there to learn the piano and to be involved in theater and drama. And so it's been part of my life always. It's always been a passion. It sits right in the middle of my heart. But as I grew and I went away to school and I met issues that were challenging to me, racism, how to define it, how to move it, the war. There are just a number of issues. I'm a child of the 60s and 70s and a young adult in the 60s and 70s. And so there was a lot of work going on at that time. And I just jumped into it. I jumped into women's groups and anti-war groups and social change groups. And I thought that I had to give up my art. Well, nobody's doing art. Let me do this work. And so I went on for a while just kind of negating what I felt at my center. And then I met some people who in New York who were doing poetry as social justice. And I thought, oh, okay. By this time, I had moved to Seattle, Washington. This is a long story.
This is a great story. I'm enthralled with it. Please, keep going.
Well, so I took that little nugget, because I didn't work with those people in New York. I just kind of saw them, and it just put a light on in my head. And I went back to Seattle at the time, and I started talking to other people who were in social justice work and who were also artists, dancers and writers and actors and directors, et cetera, et cetera. And we started one time with just one little poem that we found by Pablo Neruda. And we performed that poem through movement, recitation and movement. And we created something we called choreo poetry. And from there, it just kind of opened up really wide the possibilities of it, because audience reaction to it was so intense, and they were so moved, and people gave us so much positive feedback that we kept going with it. And then we formed a group called the Choreo Poets, and the purpose of it was to explore what are the art forms and what can the arts do with social change and social justice. And some of our models were, if you can walk, you can dance, if you can talk, you can sing. So anybody who's interested in it came into the group, and then we trained each other. And we opened for people like Angela Davis and Gil Scott-Heron, and we opened for a number of different people. It was a very exciting time. And it's only in retrospect, unfortunately, that I realize how important that group was. It was very important to me. I learned in that group, myself as a young person, the power of transformation through the arts. That the arts, being able to use the arts, to understand the arts, to affect change, those are really empowering events. They give you a sense of power that many things do not. If you come from a background in which you have been diminished, in which your culture has been diminished, or your gender, or your sexual orientation, and you find something, you have a nugget that has given you power, then that in itself is transformative. And I use that idea as I continue to work in education and higher education with young people and with teachers as I began to teach.
And as you work with young people and you work with, I'm thinking of teachers and I'm thinking of other professional caregivers, there's a lot of people, and this is certainly argued in education, that teaching is an apolitical process, and there are many childcare practitioners who would say, you know, child and youth work is an apolitical process. It's about helping that particular individual, not about trying to change the world or train the structures around them. It's about supporting that individual. Why should those of us who work with children and youth, why should we care about the larger structures and transforming the world?
That I've heard that. You have no idea how many times I've heard that. I don't look at color. All the children are all saying to me, and I say to them, number one, there is no such thing as apolitical. Everything is political. Everything. Where you get your shoes from, where the children come from, their housing, their food, their, everything is political. It's about who has it, who does it, who has the power, who does it. Your teaching job is a political job. Who hires you? Who demands what of you? How much power do you have in speaking to it? All of those issues are political. Now, if we think of politics as Democrat and Republicans here in the United States, then we have a very limited understanding of what political is. Political. Politics is about power. Who has it and who doesn't? And what do they, and what comes in society because of the relationship between the powerful and the powerless, or those people who perceive themselves as powerless. Right? And that's an important point, because perception is everything. And so when I talk to teachers about that, that's one level of what I say. The other is, and I'm going to bite my sarcastic tongue here. I'm trying to say it without being sarcastic. Okay, when you look at me, I'm an African-American woman. When you look at me, it is an insult. It is not wonderful. It is an insult for you to say you do not see my color. You do not see my struggle. You do not see my story. Who are you to decide that for me? Who are you to try and teach me in a way that only you know, but you know nothing of me? Teaching and learning is a reciprocal process. You have to learn in order to be a good teacher. If you're not willing to learn, then you're not a good teacher. And so for those who say teaching is apolitical or the arts are apolitical, they really are in need of some further development, because the world is full of difference, and we have to be able to acknowledge difference. We have a lot of commonality. We are one species, true. But in our journey through this life on this planet, we have all got differences, even individual differences, and they speak to that. But we also have collective differences. And culture is a collective issue. So if you're going to talk about if you're going to deny that children are different, you're denying culture. And everybody has culture. Although I've met lots of teachers who don't think they have culture.
Yes, I've met lots of child and youth care practitioners who feel the same way. I'd like to talk about a specific project that you worked on called the Tubman Theater Project, and you worked on this for many years, and you've written about this, and I want to bring this to a very concrete level for this portion of our conversation. So all the participants in that program were Black children or self-identified African-American children, and you have written that you were working, you used arts with these young people to, quote, be creative and critical change agents who challenge demeaning perceptions and practices, end quote. And this seems to go to the heart of what you were just saying. How can art challenge these demeaning perceptions and practices?
Well, you know, and it is so thick. I mean, it is really deep here in the United States. We all build on history, and so we, all of us, no matter what ethnicity, we all build on history, and we come from somewhere, and we carry the baggage of it. And so in public schools, the kids that I've worked with come, particularly these kids, many of whom have been suspended over and over again, or who have low grades or low achievement levels, and a lot of them have internalized the notion of you are Black and therefore you are not too smart, which is an underlying whispered, almost unconscious notion that runs throughout the society that has come from way back, long ago, and it still rides in the wind. And our children, I have seen teachers of all kinds. I've seen white teachers and black teachers who carry this notion. And so the kids have internalized that. They've internalized, well, school is really not my thing because I'm really not good at this stuff and I really don't. I have a number of children who think that they aren't smart. It's really amazing to me. And these kids, these are articulate, intelligent, funny, creative kids who think they aren't smart, and partially because they think it's because they're black. And so when we engage them in, there's kind of two levels of the art. One of them is what we call aesthetics, that's looking at the art, being audience to the art. The other is creating the art. And those two work together. So that when you present to kids who think their culture is not as good as others, or who think their own intelligence is not up to par, you present them with models of people who have created something that they can stand and interpret, and they can bring their knowledge to, that they can ask questions about, and that their ideas and thinking are not wrong. It's different. If you can create that space for them, and then to help them to create art form that release their voice, release their voices. These kids, what I did with them is I collected their stories because we only had a 10-week block of time. And they'd come every morning for 3 hours. They'd leave school and come to the theater. So already we have taken them out of the place where they thought they weren't smart into a theater where there's all kinds of possibilities.
I just want to say that in and of itself, I think, is an incredible intervention to be able to remove these young people 3 hours every morning for 10 weeks. Later you have to tell us how you managed to get that to happen, because that seems almost miraculous to me. Anyway, so yeah. You remove them, you bring them to this space of the theater, this space of imagination, of creativity, of transformation. Then what happened?
Then there were two directors and me, and I was the collector's story. So we had long conversations about those things that were important to them, issues that were a problem for them. What are the issues in your community? What are the issues in your life that you want to speak to? And I'd collect their stories and create a one act for them to critique. I'd take it back to them. They'd say, no. We had long discussions about wonderful questions. There was one play that I wrote had to do with drugs, that whether or not it was okay for a young man to sell drugs to feed his family. And that became an argument that went on and on and on, and until one young woman whose mother was hooked on crack spoke to it, and that discussion transformed the young men's minds about, you know, that it's not just one thing. There are many. What you do, the consequences are multiple. So don't only think about one thing. Think about many things. What does this happen? So that sort of discussion about the play itself were really heated and exciting, and then when the piece was finished, and meanwhile, the two directors were taking them through acting and theater games and honing their skills, their performance skills. And so then they'd get the script, and we had a couple of read-arounds of the scripts and discussion of the scripts, and then they had to set a date and to perform it for their community, for their parents, for their schools, in their schools, and then we toured it to other schools.
And what was the response of the audience to watch these young people who suspended, who've been dealing with all these issues, who've internalized this racism to the extent where they don't believe that they have the capacity, and here they are creating theater, performing theater, writing theater. What was the impact?
Ha-ha! Teachers came up to us and said, how did you do that? You know, it's kind of like, it was really, the response was really powerful. Parents came up. One of the things that we did is after each performance, the students came out on the stage and they answered questions for people in the audience. And so this whole process was a process of power building, that they recognized who they were and what they could possibly do. And parents and teachers and principals and administrators were awed by what happened, the transformation of these kids. But the sad part was, after the 10 weeks, they had to go back. They didn't want to go back, but they had to go back. And for me, is the lingering wound of that exciting. I've met some of those kids since then, and many of them kept a kernel of what they learned there, but a lot of them went back to their old ways because they were captured. What that taught me was there is a way to teach kids that transforms them, and that the school system needs to learn how to do that much better. That's why I went on to do a PhD, so I could start teaching teachers, because I saw that there is a way to catch these kids before they fell into the prison pipeline, before they fell into drugs and alcohol. It was a way to catch these in middle school kids, and that was a pivotal place for changing. They liked the program so much that they switched us to high school students, and that was a whole nother kettle of fish.
I'm sure. You know, the irony, or I'll say tragedy, that when the teachers and the principal and the administrators see the possibility and the reality of how much these young people have to offer, that only happens when they're removed from the school, is an incredible tragedy.
One of the things that I've learned as a scholar of education is that it is an institution, and institutions are very, very, very slow to change, and it takes a lot of people cracking away at the walls, making cracks here, making cracks there, until it starts to crumble. It does not go easily. It is long, and especially education, because there are so many stakeholders, and everybody thinks they know how to teach. So it's like the policy people make policy based on their issues, but they're not making policy based on the issues of children. They're making policy based on money, based on taxes, based on what all the other issues they have. But the kids, that's a whole other kettle of fish. Institutions are very difficult to crack. And so when I think back, because I was incensed by this all when I was involved with this program, and this substance program, and saw what happened to the kids when they went back. But I've got a sense of why those teachers, it's going to take a while. We have a lot of work to do to transform the institution of education. I don't know about Canada, but I definitely know the United States.
Yes, we certainly have work here, and as an educator, I'm confronted daily with, you know, my own limits, my own racist practices as a white man, my own structural limits, and it's ongoing.
Yeah.
In the introduction, I said that you co-edited a book called Culturally Relevant Arts Education for Social Justice, A Way Out of No Way. There's so much in that title. We could do the entire interview on that title alone. Let's start, though, with, could you explain the concept of culturally relevant arts education?
Well, now you got a couple of hours. You know, it's funny, that title, we went round and around with the publisher. We wanted A Way Out of No Way to come to first, but we went around and around with the publisher, and so she wanted nothing to do with A Way Out of No Way, so we compromised. We got our little bit, she got her little bit.
And I certainly want you to tell a little bit the history of A Way Out of No Way, because that saying is culturally rich, and I think it's crucial that we have a bit of that conversation as well. But you can choose. How about you choose, since you didn't get to choose the title of the book? Which would you prefer to start with?
Well, I think I talked a little bit about A Way Out of No Way when I'm talking about the kids and the ways that they've internalized their oppression. They've internalized it. And I think for African-American people, that phrase is a really deep and powerful phrase because it speaks to our resilience and our creativity. And, I mean, considering the Holocaust of Africans and the long journeys and the slavery and the Jim Crow and the lynching and on and on and on it's gone, and still we are in some ways, our art forms were the only place of freedom. And it was through that freedom in those art forms that we retained a sense of self, we retained a sense of history, we retained a sense of loving and power, because like I said, the arts are transformative. They transform who you are as you create it. They transform who others are when they hear it or listen or observe it. And so in those really dark, dark days, the arts were really important in helping us to be resilient and to keep moving forward. And so there are lots of ways that phrase is used, but I use it, and the people who worked on the book use it, as a reminder of how important the arts have always been to oppressed people. I mean, always. It is, when you think about hip-hop, for example, you know, I did some research on hip-hop. Hip-hop was created in the South Bronx when it was devastated. It was wiped out. They had sent a highway down the middle of it. People had left. It was like a wasteland. And out of the middle of all of that, this little kernel of something rose up, and voila, we have a whole new art form. And that art form, by the way, is such a democratic art form that has spread among youth like it's nothing I have ever experienced or seen. I found middle school kids who would cut school to go down to the mall, mind you, not to go shop or shoplift, but to stand in the mall and freestyle with words, to play with words with a group of other kids that said, forget school, I'm going down here to do something I want to do. I mean, I have the spoken word movement that came out of hip-hop and other sources, and as well as hip-hop itself and all of the forms that it has taken, is truly an example of a way out of no way. You just can't stop it. It's what human beings do. We are hardwired to create. In my life, I've had ideas that came to me, and you kind of hit yourself in the forehead and go, ah, yeah, that's it. Well, I was reading something by John Dewey, who's a philosopher and educator, and he said that human beings create form in order to transform or manage the chaos. life is chaotic. It is. It's really chaotic. The issue these kids face is chaotic. That means from inside the house to outside the house, decision making, doing this, do I do that? I mean, it's chaos. And if you create an art form, it helps you to manage it. It helps you to take a look at it, to step back and look at the familiar in an unfamiliar way. And then to make decisions about it, make decisions about the art form and the medium. But it also helps you to make sense of your life. And there's a internal voice and an external voice. It gives you permission to externalize your voice, but it also, as important, I know for me as an artist, as important, it helps me to organize my internal voice. So I pull together all of those pieces of chaos and say, ah, this is what I feel. This is what I know. This is what I experience. These are the questions I have. So a way out of no way, that is what you get as a way out of no way through the art. And now the culturally relevant arts education, which we call CREA, is on the one level, this kind of multicultural education is kind of two levels, but it's all about transformation. On the one level, it is looking at the arts as a way to transform how kids are taught in school. And not only making the arts, which is one thing, but arts integration, so learning about other things using the arts as a vehicle. And the third one is aesthetics, learning about the art form, going to see plays, going to hear music, going to making sense of the arts in the world and how the arts have transformed the world, that sort of thing. So there are three levels, there are three different approaches to the art. The other part of it is that it is deeply rooted in multicultural education and critical multicultural education and critical pedagogy, which I'll explain just a minute. And then that is the kind of the secondary level of CREA. And that is to raise critical consciousness. This is not just some form of working with the arts. This is about helping kids to turn on their oppression, to examine who they are, to understand better who they are and what is happening in the world so that they can be the transformative people that they really are, that they can support their natural curiosity about the world, to support their natural creativity and imagination, and then to look at it in ways that they can transform their society. You know, I asked middle school students and high school students, if you could change the world, what would you do? And none of them have ever said, well, I wouldn't do anything. And now they're all invested in changing the world. They all would like to do that. And now is the time for them to look at how they might do that. Mainly because the world is, you know, we are at the edge. Frankly, we are right at the precipice. The idea that the extinction of the species comes from when it fails to adapt. We are right at the edge of extinction because we are failing to adapt. And that's we teach children for the future, for their future. We can't understand what will be in their future. But if they cannot, they don't have the tools to address what transformation they need to do or what they need to do to create a society that is sustainable, that encompasses a wider group of people. The globe is very small. How do we do this thing? If we don't have kids who are able to answer those questions, I think I've gone off into a tangent.
I think your tangent, I agree, right? How do we create the opportunities for people to answer those questions, to think through those questions, to transform themselves, and in that process transform the world and each other. And yeah. I think you really do show the no way, and I think your passion speaks to the way out of that. Several times during our conversation, I got chills down my spine because your commitment comes through and the need for this work comes through. As we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to touch on before we end our conversation?
One of the caveats that I like to extend is that there are many ways to teach fear. And I think that sometimes artists, not only teachers, but artists say that, you know, I'm teaching them to dance. I'm not teaching them about something else. And my take on that is that if you teach a child to dance or you teach a child to create, that you're giving them tools, whether you like it or not. There is wonder in learning a skill or a discipline. There's a lot of value in teaching those things. And so just by teaching them, you are involved in transformation of the world. Because an artist is by very nature a transformer. You can't be an artist and not transform something. I mean, you just can't. I mean, if you're not transforming something and you're creating art, you're not creating art. I don't know exactly what you're doing, but you're not creating art, because no matter what you do, art is transformative. I mean, ballet dances, they transform what people see and understand the body can do. I mean, the world of knowledge is very wide and very large. The other thing, the other question is, if you work with children and if you're working, all children actually, but specifically if you're working with children who are in trouble of any kind, whether it's that their parents are so rich they're too busy to pay attention to them, or their parents are so poor that they have their own issues to deal with, or their children themselves, or the society is preparing them to be fodder, that an artist, a person who works with children in those situations and who cannot see the importance of social justice work as a part of that, is really not paying attention, or they really need to be in some other session, or they need to be developing their understanding of the world. You know, I've lived long enough that I know that people go through developmental changes as adults. It doesn't stop when you're 18, you keep going. And sometimes people, younger groups, fail to see the connection between the arts and change and justice, simply because they haven't quite gotten to that point themselves. Nothing's happened to them, maybe, that ignited a wish for better justice. And so if there's someone who's listening who really doesn't see the importance of justice and they're working with kids who need justice, then I would ask them to really kind of get down into themselves and begin to learn what there is out there in the world.
I would agree, and I think a wonderful place to start is your book, A Way Out of No Way, Culturally Relevant Art Education for Social Justice. You can read a lot more of Dr. Hanley's writings at Hanley Arts. I'll put a link up on our website, c2ypodcast.org, but if you just search Mary Stone Hanley or type in marystonehanley.com, you'll find it. I want to so thank you for taking the time out of your day today to share with us, to bring awareness of the importance of social justice for all of us who work with children and youth, to challenge us to think about our perception, or the perception sometimes, of the apolitical nature of our work, that we're just here to support the child as they develop rather than looking at the structures that are around them. And I want to thank you for all the work you've been doing over your whole life, and for passing that on to all the young people you're working with now. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.